Good afternoon. My name is Buck. I'm alcoholic. It's a pleasure to see you. Welcome. The topic for this session is our critics can be our benefactors. If you're looking for another topic, you're in the wrong room, but we're glad you're here. I'd like to ask you now, and I'll do this too, if you have a cell phone, let's turn it off or turn it to vibrate so you can enjoy the experience. I'd like to ask my brothers and sisters of Alcoholics Anonymous to please take a moment that we can have silence and gratitude for the recoveries of AA for the past 75 years. My home group is the Yays and Nays group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which meets every Tuesday morning at 7:45 on the House of Representatives side of the United States Capitol. If you're ever in Washington, D.C., and you get a chance to come to Washington and visit, please come to us. But get there at 7:30 because you got to go through security. The guards wear big guns, and, you know, you don't get strip searched, but you got to take everything out of your pockets. It's the best group in AA. I just joined a group in Idaho, but Madeline will tell you about that later. My sobriety date is a blessing to my family. They prayed me into these rooms, and to my friends, and to all of you who have supported me. It's coming up, July 7th, 1987. I'm grateful to be sober. I have a sponsor. He has a sponsor. And that sponsor, the grand sponsor, spoke last night, and it wasn't the young guy. You'll figure it out. When I got the loving invitation to moderate this panel, I saw the names of two people who I have seen in service, who I've served with, who I admire greatly. When I saw one earlier today, it brought tears to my eyes because I know that nobody loves AA more than anybody in this room, and nobody has worked harder for AA than some of the people, all of the people that you'll hear from today. So when we talk about our critics can be our benefactors, it doesn't own, you know, Bill used to say in some of the writing that we've read and in our literature and in the grapevine, that sometimes the only thing that can kill AA is from within. So we're going to talk about criticism, how we take it individually, how we take it as a society. We're going to think about those things. These are the things that we'll put on the table. I have no idea what these people are going to talk about. They do. But let me read you just a brief excerpt from Bill, who wrote in AA Comes of Age on page 231. In the years ahead, we shall, of course, make mistakes. Experience has taught us that we need have no fear of doing this, providing that we always remain willing to confess our faults and to correct them promptly. Our growth as individuals has depended upon this healthy process of trial and error. So will our growth as a fellowship. Let us always remember that any society of men and women that cannot freely correct its own faults must surely fall into decay, if not into collapse. Such is the universal penalty for the failure to go on growing, just as each AA must continue to take his moral inventory and act upon it, so it is must our whole society if we are to survive, and if we are to serve usefully and well. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our first speaker from down the street, 30 minutes away. I said, do you live on a farm? She said, we have ranches. We don't have farms. She is an intergroup groupie, and we are delighted to have her. Please welcome our first speaker, Carolyn B.
I'm Carolyn. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since February 22nd, 1988, and I am really grateful for that. You know, and as he said, I'm a Texas girl, so if you have a little trouble listening to me, you'll just have to slow down your listening because I can't speed up my talking. You know, I first checked out AA in 1987 when, you know, shortly after he got sober, and I decided that I wasn't going to be an alcoholic because I didn't like your steps. And I darn almost said the word. And I, you know, the Texas girl, we say a few words every once in a while. And I sure wasn't going to have anything to do with God because, you know, from my selfish perception, when my husband had been killed in a plane crash 21 years earlier and left me with a baby boy, and I decided that God must really have it in for me because he'd also taken away my dad. You know, he had moved away with some other family. And so I decided, and I told him, that's it. I'm going to make it in spite of you. And so I went on to do that for a good while. But when I came into AA 6 months later, after that decision that I wasn't going to be one, I still told you, I'm not doing your steps. And I'm not doing God, but I want to quit drinking because I don't ever want to feel the way I feel again, like I had when my daughter told me, sometimes when you drink, you get mean just like Dad. So I, you know, started coming to your meetings, and over time, I did that thing that that Dr. Addict Alcoholic talks about, and I said, I'm an alcoholic of sorts. And so I guess I'll have to do it. You know, I still was hedging my bets a little bit. Just a little bit about me personally. You know, I was, you know, born out in the hill country, which is real poor country. And it was back then. Now apparently it costs quite a bit. But it was real poor. And I had always been poor. And I didn't even know that until I went away to college. And, you know, and found that maybe I wasn't really as unequal as I had thought I had in some ways, but I certainly was financially. So I found that the way I could make it in life, I had about four good coping skills: marriage, divorce, therapy, and school. So, and I ended up finally with a doctor of philosophy, but with a minor in rhetoric. So if I don't know the answer, I can sure convince you that I do. So when I did that thing about resigning from the debating society at AA, that was something else. When I got the letter from the General Service Board, and, you know, I read that on the outside, and I first thought, oh no, what have they heard? And then, oh, who told them? So I started, you know, kind of thinking, how would this have happened? And finally, you know, I called the secretary in my first home group, and he said, don't you know it was about that intergroup stuff that you do? And I said, oh, okay, because I couldn't imagine how they would have gotten my name down here in Texas. As I thought about it, I thought, you know, I can't do this. I don't know anything about this, and I won't be any good at it. And I remembered back the first time I was invited by a group to go do the steps that my sponsor said to me, you'll learn a lot about yourself. And I did then, and I certainly have, you know, in this, in preparation for this. I'm not going to just give you my experience, strength, and hope, because some other people have a lot more, but I wanted to tell you about the journey I kind of took to get here. You know, and when I saw this topic, our critics can be our benefactors, I thought, okay, they want me as a nurse to tell them about all the stuff I've seen, problems with health care. But then I figured, well, no, that's probably not it. And about a week later, I was having a weekly meeting, reading Language of the Heart at my house, and the one that we read that next week was a letter that was written by Bill Wilson, or an article, in response to a critique of a book by Philip Wiley. And Philip Wiley is actually the guy who wrote A Generation of Vipers, you know, which gave us momism, and he did some science fiction that was the origin of Superman. But what he had reviewed was a book by Charles Jackson called the lost weekend. And when he read that, he said, you know, this is astounding. And he had written a review that described it as having the very best description of the jitters that he had ever seen. He said, you know, he remembered that feeling of sitting alone and the shakes and all that stuff. And he said that book was the best he'd seen. And he also said, you know, that he had gotten his own sobriety without AA. He had done it through what he called scientific psychological techniques that he learned with Carl Jung. When Bill Wilson talked about Wiley's article, he said he described it as like an abundance of fresh fruit, food for thought, so that we in AA must never think we have a monopoly on reviving drunks. So, having that little academic preparation that I do, I went right to the internet and found Wiley's article and thought, well, there might be something more here. So I Googled criticism plus AA, and wow, let me tell you, something like, a, you know, over 11,000 articles on criticism and AA. But I also, at that point, was introduced to Silkworth.net, aabibliography.net, aagrapevine.org. So there were, you know, many opportunities to study. And one of the things that really struck me, I saw Penn and Teller on there. You know, they're the magician sort of comic thing, and they had quite a rant. They did not think much of AA at all. Fortunately, I didn't have too big a reaction. Then later, as I was getting a little closer to thinking about what I might write down, I looked in Language of the Heart, and that's when I found the article that he just read from, that Bill Wilson wrote in 1963. Excuse me, I took a sinus pill, but we're in a different area than the ones that I normally have to take. And the one that Bill Wilson wrote was that our critics can be our benefactors. And he did that in response to an article that had shown up in Harper's Magazine that was written in February that year by Dr. Arthur H. Kane. And he was a psychologist. And the article that he wrote was titled, Alcoholics Can Be Cured Despite AA. And the next year, he wrote another very interesting article on the same topic that was AA cult or cure. So Dr. Kane did mention in one place that he had treated and helped at least 50 alcoholics. But he said in the article that he wrote that AA is a dogmatic cult whose chapters too often turn society into slavery to AA. He didn't advocate that anybody quit, but he said, you know, that if you're having trouble, there might be something else. Then he suggested that AA should return to its original purpose of being a much-needed first aid station, and then that people could go on and find their cure in many other areas, like psychology, psychoanalysis, or whatever worked for them. Bill's article said, you know, as he read the introduction to it, that he spoke specifically to that thing of inventory and to looking at our own reaction, for one thing, you know, and also that for AA as a whole, looking at criticism with an open eye to seeing what we might learn from it. He said it would be a product of false pride to believe that AA is a cure-all, even for alcohol. That, he added, we must never become so vain as to suppose that we have been the authors and inventors of a new religion. And out in Deep East Texas, where I live now, I've moved out of Dallas, you know, there's an awful lot of what would not go in a lot of places, because they, you know, my group members often talk about, you know, the Lord's doing this for them and the Lord's doing that, and you don't hear higher power mentioned much. So I do my best to remind them that you know, AA is not the religion, and the God that you believe in may not fit for everyone, but it's kind of an ongoing thing. Bill Wilson continued, every AA principle has been borrowed from ancient sources, and we merely hold ourselves ready to cooperate with religion and medicine as assistants. He stated further that holding any religious convictions is a matter of personal privilege, but there's also an equal privilege to hold none. He reviewed the 12 concepts. It was one of the things that he referred to in response to this criticism. And, you know, the fifth warranty in the concept says that we cannot or should not ever be personally punitive or incite to public controversy. And Bill Wilson said we should never enter into any controversy, even in our own defense. The best defense in circumstances of attack would be no defense whatever, namely complete silence at the public level. You know, and when you hear some of those things, you know, this morning one of the speakers said before she came into AA, she had the notion that we were cults, that we have all those little mantras that we say, keep coming back one day at a time. All that sounds kind of cultish. And we, remind people often the benefits that they can get here, and not always with the clarity that it's the higher power that carries through and provides the benefit rather than us or any single group. One of the other things that I found that I thought was so very interesting, and see, I've been on a real learning path here, as I told you, because I didn't know all this was in there. There was an article or an address given by Bob Pearson in 1986. He was a retiring GSO senior advisor, and he'd been 18 years working in the General Service Office. In his address, he stated, and I quote, if AA falters, it will not be due to either treatment centers, professionals in the field, non-conference literature, young people, dually addicted, or even druggies trying to come to our closed meetings. The greatest dangers to AA then are probably as today, is the growing rigidity, the increasing demand for absolute answers to nitpicking questions. And I thought, and I thought of one of my new sponsees when that came, and I wanted to have her read it. But okay, that in nitpicking questions, pressure. For GSO to enforce our traditions, screening alcoholics at closed meetings, and prohibiting non-conference literature, and laying more and more rules on groups and members. So, yeah. See, when I read that, I thought, that, you know, that's pretty amazing. That's, so over 20 years ago, and some of these things have been going on over the last 40 years. Those things that happen from the outside where people don't think we're doing it quite right. One of the ones that I found that I thought was really most interesting was an article that was about a woman and man in Ireland who had written a book. And they had tried AA and found out it just didn't work. They kept, you know, having trouble. And so finally, you know, they started in one of those other groups that are available to people to get sufficient help. And their book was entitled Phoenix in the Bottle, you know, rising out of those ashes. And the review stated that they had challenged AA to open debate about whether or not, you know, we really are a cult or whether we have really anything to offer. A couple of times I ended up just doing that thing that you get told in AA when you don't know what to do, take a deep breath. And remember, they've got their opinion, and we all know what opinions are worth. So I sat down to ponder, you know, this a little further, and what I came up with is that we have such wonderful statements in the Big Book and our other literature that tell us how to behave in the face of criticism and to grow from it. One of those, you know, in the fourth step, it talks about the brainstorm and the grouch are not for us. And I can always see other people's problems. Whenever I'm upset, there's something wrong with me. And finally, that self-examination, prayer, and meditation provide an unshakable foundation for life. So that experience that I've gained from AA, you know, both in staying sober, working with others, through other service work, and at intergroup office and on the intergroup board for Greater Dallas, I've really come up with a great deal of humility and a great respect for how cogent Bill Wilson was when he put together the service structure that we have and made it to insulate and protect us from ourselves. You see, when you look at that one part in the book where it says we are all childish and emotionally sensitive, you know, I don't want to be in any open debate with anybody who's in rational recovery because I'm likely to say a few words they wouldn't want to hear. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here and share with you.
Carolyn, thank you for your words. You have in your program today a speaker from Kansas by the name of Jimmy B. There is no such person. There is a person, however, named Jimmy Jack B. And if you're like me from the East Coast and you have a problem here understanding our first speaker, Carolyn, you were very good. I didn't need a translator. But coming up for you, you're going to need a translator. There should be English, French, Spanish, and Jimmy Jack Bailey. Now, Jimmy Jack Bailey, I had the pleasure of serving with Jimmy Jack. We were both panel 54 delegates to the General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in our second year, he was the delegate chair, which meant he was like the grand poobah, ran the meetings. When it came time for things that were going on, at that point, I was a three-term delegate, and I was really upset about something. It was criticism from within, not towards me, but some criticism. And Jimmy Jack Bailey said to me, "Get over it." When he calls me on the phone, he has his own special ringtone. Jimmy Jack has his own ringtone with, for him and two other panel 54s, and I'd like you to hear this because this is the vintage, and as this plays, he'll come up because he knows that this is his song. So just bear with me a second here, okay?
You have till 2:20.
I have till
220.
Oh. Thank you, Buck. My name is Jimmy Jack. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July the 16th, 1985. For that, I'm truly grateful. And, you know, I didn't know who sent my name in, and whenever I got this letter from Rick and I read the topic, he immediately went to the top of the prayer list. I want to thank Carolyn for all of her. I've typed up I don't know how much for this deal and worked on it ever since I got the letter. And I've thrown away probably everything that she said two or three times. Now I know why she was going first. She was going to do it. And this morning when I left the room, you know, I got on my knees and I said a lot of prayers, and I just loaded my guns and come to town. I have a hard time reading anything because I like to look at the people that I'm talking to. I think the looking into the eyes is, the witness to the soul. And, you know, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love alcoholics a great dearly. And, and what I see, and I talked to a lot of people before I got here, and I talked to a lot of people that's been around a lot since I've been here. And what I wanted to say has changed a jillion times since I've been here. I'd like to tell you that my home group is simply AA in Pratt, Kansas, and that's just all it means. It's simply AA. We meet on Monday and Thursday nights. If you're ever in town, we'd love to have you. Both our meetings are open, so we invite anybody to come in, doctors, lawyers, or whatever. We have sponsorship so strong, if you're not alcoholic, you're not going to participate. You know, our requirement for membership is you have a desire not to talk if you're not alcoholic. Because we want you to know about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I live in a town of 6,000 people. Or, yeah, 6,300. They just run the census. We're down a little bit. I think we killed a few of them. So. And you know, we laugh at that. And through the thinking and the research that I've done about what we're talking about tonight, is I think that we've allowed some of our criticism within Alcoholics Anonymous to keep some people from coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very one of them that... You know, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 12-stepped in, not into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 12-stepped into a treatment center by somebody I went to kill. We had some bad deals, and he owed me some money, and I went to kill it. And when I left there, I ended up going to a treatment center. He's still alive. I don't know where he's at. But what had an impact on me then that I don't see a lot of today is that I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous that was doing the work that needed to be done. They were cooperating with the treatment facilities. They were whatever. They were there, and they led me into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was led into to Big Book, old-style AA. And I'm one of them that they told me when I got here, because I come here with an opinion. Y'all probably didn't. I didn't wake up some morning and say, yippee-ki-yay, I'm going to AA either. But when I got here, they told me to sit down, shut up, and be quiet. I assured them that I'd just come out of treatment. And I had a lot of answers. And my earlobes got long because, you know, they just dragged me out of the meetings, and they'd set me down, and we'd chat a little bit. Or they did a lot of chatting. I did a lot of listening. They assured in me that God gave me two ears and one mouth for a reason. And I needed to listen twice as much as I talked. And they started explaining what put Alcoholics Anonymous together. It went all the way back from Yoon to Roland to Abby to Bill, and they followed that process. And they said, you know, this deal has worked real successfully. We don't have the only answer, but we're liable to have the only wrench that's going to fit a nut like you. And they did that. And you know, and I'm a history buff, and I'll grant you I'm the least educated at this table. You can probably tell that already. But I went back, and the membership of Alcoholics Anonymous was astronomical growth up to the printing of the second edition Big Book. And then it started a decline. And as we printed more literature, we begin to decline in our success rate a little bit more. And what I found out in that is Alcoholics Anonymous members have somewhere in that neighborhood have got lazy. And if we went to spending so much time with the criticism within inside Alcoholics Anonymous rather than just going and doing what we should be doing to start with. You know, I found in my area is Kansas, and you know, we've got our problems just like everybody else that I talk to. And, you know, we nitpick at each other. And, you know, and it's nice to back off and separate and look for that. And are we really doing what Bill set out for us to do? You know, 55 years ago today, The fellowship took control of Alcoholics Anonymous. I happened to pick up AA Comes of Age this morning, and I read that. And, you know, we'd been through the trial period, and the resolution was passed today unanimously that the fellowship owned Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I was talking to an old-timer yesterday, and he said that he'd been reading some of Bill's writings. And Bill had talked about, you know, that he knew that he had laid a grassroots plan out for how we should carry on at Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was so sure that Alcoholics Anonymous members would never get so complacent and lazy that we wouldn't continually to do what they had done all those years. And then this guy looked at me and he goes, what do you think Bill would think about what he sees in Alcoholics Anonymous today? He might roll over on his stomach. You know, and it's nobody's fault but ours. You know, the treatment centers we talk about, you know, in my home group, and it totally amazed me, we got real active, you know, and we went back to the doctors. We become friends with the doctors. We begin to be friends with the clergy again. And do you know how many doctors that I've talked to that don't know nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous? Mm-hmm. Why ain't we friends with our friends anymore? You know, go to treatment centers and let them know that we're available to cooperate. You know, and help them. And, you know, we talk about all these things we're not doing, but we don't ever get up off of our tail and do these things. You know, and I think it has to go back to me as an individual through sponsorship and everything else. And I've got to take the people that I work with and show them precisely what they showed me. And that's what I do. Anybody that knows anybody that I sponsor, you got to kick them out of the way. You know, a newcomer comes in the door, it's kind of like roadkill in Texas. You got buzzards all around them. Buck don't know what roadkill is, so somebody tell him here. But you know, if we'll get back to doing, you know, we've had all of the criticism and what we really benefited from that criticism, we've quit paying attention to. And you know, and I go back and look at the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, was wrote and founded on the criticism that we could benefit from. You know, if you come in and you do these things, this will happen. You know, I'm not one that thinks we, and I'd have to be lying if I told you I've read all of the literature that Alcoholics Anonymous has read. And I'd be willing to bet there's very few in this room that's read all of the literature that Alcoholics Anonymous has read. I'm a doer. You know, they told me I'd do it, and I'd hand somebody a pamphlet and said, you read this, and this is what will happen. You know, and I think we've relied on that for so long that we've learned to lean back on our heels and rest on our thumbs and think everything's going to be okay. You know, I'm one of them that think that we could do without probably a third of the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and maybe a third of the membership in Alcoholics Anonymous and be way better off. That didn't go over real well, did it?
Say it again.
And, Buck wants this to replay. I didn't get shot the first time, so I think I'll be quiet the second time. But you know why I say that is meeting. We hear all the time meeting makers make it. And you know, and I know if I could have come into Alcoholics Anonymous and sit down in a meeting and my life had changed immediately, I probably would not be in Alcoholics Anonymous today. I'd just find out don't drink. But when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and had a desire to change my life got worse. And people led me through a process that was outlined in that book that changed my life. You know, my home group meets twice a week. You know, and I think that's all I need to do, you know. And what kind of hope do I have? I've got some teenagers coming to meetings in Pratt, Kansas. How would you like to be 18 years old in a town of 6,000 people and be told you got to come and sit in a cold steel chair every day for the rest of your life? Boy, that'd make you sign up in a heartbeat. You know, what we do is we meet them two nights, we show them that you can have fun, we take them and we get them involved, and we show them what they needed to do to the next one that come in. You know, we use it as it's outlined in the book, you know, by the time you're a member of Simply AA in 30 days, you're to the ninth step, or we want you to go drink till you get ready. 75% of the people walk in that door are not drinking again. I think if you'll read the foreword to the second edition, it talks about that. You know, probably the grandest compliment I've ever been paid in Alcoholics Anonymous is my grand sponsor said, you know, you'd have fit in better with the first 100. I think that's a grand compliment. Because that was whenever Alcoholics Anonymous worked at its best. We listened to our critics, we learned from them, and we moved forward. You know, and I think that's what Bill firmly intended. When he turned it over to us, he didn't think that we would deviate from what had been so successful. You know, and we die from within. You know, I hear all of the time, somebody come up to me yesterday saying, I'm going to cut off my contributions. I said, why? Because I don't like what they're doing. I said, don't cut it off. Send them so damn much they don't know what to do with it. I said, that's a proper use of contributions. Then tell them what you want them to do. You know, because if you cut off contributions, you're going to ask somebody to cut services. And I've got a son that's probably never going to need this deal, and I've got a daughter-in-law that's never going to need this deal, but I got two granddaughters that to live with them parents are going to need this deal. And I do not want to be the one to have to make a decision to cut a service that might save one of their lives. So, you know, we need to quit playing into the criticisms so much and do like Carolyn talked about. You know, Bill's best answer was no answer at all. You know, he talked about in the 12 and 12 on the 10 step constructive criticism when we're really trying to win a useless argument. How important is it really? You know, how important is it really? You know, I don't know how many times I burned a lot of energy just trying to be right when it didn't make a difference. And 2 days later, I couldn't even remember what I'd won. You know, I sat down in the lobby a while ago, and we had a heated discussion over everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. You just grinned. I said, what are you doing to change it? Well, nothing. But they sure want to talk about it. You know, I think it talks about in the third step, we made a decision. You know, I had to make a decision before I got up here and this meeting started to run down here to the men's room. Thank God I made the right decision. Because I had to take action. And you know, if you want to take anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you want to change anything, you got to take action. And we got to do these things. And you know, and I do things I don't want to do. It ain't my nature to get up in the middle of the night and go and talk to a drunk. You know, but I have the benefits of it. You know, it's pretty neat when you get phone calls from ICU nurses going, would you come up and talk to these individuals? Because what y'all are doing is working. What we're doing is not. Can you help us? When you got doctors that on their prescriptions pad write Alcoholics Anonymous and a phone number. Because you went and you've done what you're supposed to be doing. You know, you've got treatment centers that are calling you saying, hey, I need a list of the people that would make temporary sponsors or something for people coming out. They know that you're available, and then you're willing to do the stuff. And, you know, and I know places that I've called to get somebody to answer the phone, and they don't answer the phone. You know, I may never get up enough nerve but to make one phone, though. And I really and truly believe that God gives everybody one gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no guarantee they got another gift if they go back out. And you know, and I want that always to be there. And if I get so tied up in wondering whether I can take criticism, and I grant you, people that know me, you can ask some of them, there's some of them here, I take a lot of criticism. You know, my skin's pretty tough because, you know, I love you enough today that I'm going to tell you the truth. May not be like you want what you want to hear, but you know, I need sometimes to tell me, the big books worked, Jimmy Jack's theories don't. If my theories worked so well, I wouldn't be here today. I would have never had to come to you people. I was pretty amazed when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and y'all give me that blue book. Wow, 1985, they handed me a book that had my life story. That was special to me because somebody knew I was coming. And then they give me a manual that had an answer to all my problems. You know, I've been looking for them answers for a lot of years. And I come in here, and in 21 pages, you give me a power by which I could live. And I didn't want to know anything about God. But I knew him. He didn't like me. I didn't like him. We was a fussing and a fighting. But if you want a prescription to a higher power and an experience, I can write you one because I had to be electrocuted to find it. And I guarantee you, if you get hung in electricity and can't get out of it, you will surrender. And I haven't fought the God idea much since then. But I know that He works in these rooms. 4 years ago, I was given a 30% chance of being alive today. I'll never quit doing what y'all told me to do. I still kept carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today, I'm back working full time. That's nothing I had a part in. It's all I did was following directions. You know, and not playing into the criticism no more than we get sucked into, because we all get sucked into it. But it's how we react to it that causes the damage. And, you know, and I found out that my sponsor tells me that, you know, you need to learn to listen like you have no opinion. And that's the hardest thing that I ever had to do. But it allowed me to levitate up and get outside of my home group and look at Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. He says it isn't so much what you do in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's how you do it. And I want to make sure that I do what is supposed to be done to the best of my ability, the way that it worked in the past. I don't need to put Jimmy Jack's twist to it. You know, because that doesn't work real well. You know, it didn't work very good for me before I got here. You know, and I've been fortunate enough to stay around for a day or two. And I've been fortunate enough to be in service at just about every level in Alcoholics Anonymous. And every level has been a life-changing experience. And it started as a GSR, DCM, as alternate delegate, delegate, area chair. And every one of them has took my sobriety to another level. For the most part, most of the time, to another depth of humility. And I got to remember that all I am is further down the food chain the longer you've been in service. You know, in a lot of places, you know, we talk about the upside-down triangle. And if we'll remember it's upside down, we can leave the criticism out quite a bit. But a lot of people drop their book, and when they pick it up, it's upside down. And they've got that triangle in the wrong order. You know, and we've got to make sure when we pick it up, we remember where we're at. That the group members and the people coming into Alcoholics Anonymous are the ones that we need to be here to serve. And we need to listen to their criticisms of what we're doing. Is it what's best for Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, I've got a boy that I used to sponsor, and he come to me the other day and said, "You pass delegates." And I said, "I can understand that." I said, "Why don't you put this theory in your little pocket and go smoke it? What if all past delegates or anybody that had been in service before you did not show up? And we allowed y'all to make the decisions for Alcoholics Anonymous based on no knowledge or no experience. Where do you think we would be?" He goes, "You know, I never thought of that." See, that's just it. We don't think a lot of time. But we want to take quick action. We don't want to be informed. And now there's informed group consciousness, and then there's fully informed group consciousness. You know, I can inform you just enough to get my way, or I can fully inform you and maybe let God take care of it. And, you know, and that's what I've learned through a lot of criticism. And all that, I think that it's best that the people that I've sponsored and work with, they are given the full meal deal. You know, they're not directed to think the way that I think, but they're given everything that they have and available through my experience and the experience of other people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to trust that they can make the right decision as long as they rely upon God. And He's the ultimate authority anyway. You know, me and God have a little battle from time to time. You know, I get along with Him well, but I just don't ever like what He puts before me a lot of times. You know, but this has been my first international. I had an opportunity to go to Toronto, but my dad was dying, and he asked me to spend that time with him. And I got to do that, and he died that September. And it's an honor and a privilege to be here, and it's an honor and a privilege to have been allowed to be of service to people like you. Because, you know, I heard earlier this morning we talk about the newcomer being the most important person. You know, the most important person in this room to hear today is the one that is struggling the most today. And that's the one I want to be here for. And that's one I want to keep Alcoholics Anonymous pure for. Undiluted, you know, and that's it. And, you know, and it's been an honor and a privilege to be here, and I don't want to be like, I remember it. I got Buck talked about me. I'm going to take a minute or two and talk about Buck. I knew he was going to say that because, see, whenever Buck was in his second year, which was my first year as delegate, he was at the microphone all the time. Everybody got to saying, is he ever going to be quiet? And I knew today he was going to have the opportunity to tell me to be quiet. And, you know, and Buck, me and Buck become great friends. And he loves Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know how anybody could be a three-year delegate. You know, 2 years like to wore me out. But it's been an honor and privilege to stand before y'all today, and I want to thank y'all for my life. Thank you.
Jimmy Jack, I got a question for you. Did you say your town had 6,300 people? Heck, in my neighborhood, that's two blocks. We have one level of membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that level is called member. You're a member if you say you're a member. I don't get to judge that. We are blessed today to hear three individuals at different levels in the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our first speaker, Carolyn, has her experience both as a GSR and a DCM, but focuses mostly, as she said, on her inner group in Dallas. Jimmy Jack B. from Kansas is a past delegate chair for the conference, and has given us a perspective of his 2 years and what happens afterwards, before and after. The next speaker is a person who I've admired for a long time, who I don't know personally. I don't know where she lives. I don't know anything about her family. We served together at the 52nd General Service Conference when she was a delegate, and in 2006, she was elected as the trustee from the Pacific region, and I have seen her, and I admire you. We will now hear a perspective from another level of service, but the same level of membership. Please welcome our third speaker, Madeline P.
Hi, everybody. My name is Madeline, and I am an alcoholic. Did you hear that? That was the Pacific region holding their breath going, oh, no, what's she going to say? My sobriety date is November the 14th of 1985. That's right. I was a fetus. And I was born and raised in Houston, Texas. Got sober in the Serenity Group in Sprang, Texas. Where I walked into a home group with people whose nicknames were Crazy Mike, 357 Jeff, and Mongo. So Mad Dog fit in really well. But I moved to Idaho in 1993, so I always say I got the best of both worlds. I got to grow up in Texas and get sober here and have my formative years here in the Southwest region. And then I got to mature and age to perfection in the Pacific region. So, some people are still wondering about the mature part, but when I got my loving invitation, which is an oxymoron in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had my first instinct, which I always have, which this red light goes flashing my brain going, lie, lie, lie. Because I was telling someone earlier, I was the neurotically shy child who had to sit in a special chair outside the cafeteria because I couldn't sit in a room full of people. I mean, I would shake like a little nervous chihuahua, and I had this problem. I now know what the problem is because I have a pacemaker, but I used to, like, pass out. Well, I usually threw up first, then passed out like the little kid on South Park. And, oh, my God, they'd kill Kenny. Anyway, I was fun at parties as I got older, but I hated being in a huge group. I was terrified of you, and then I found alcohol. But I still, even into sobriety, do not like being in front of a podium. Some of you know how I feel about podiums. I believe that you might as well just go ahead and put stirrups on these things, because I feel the same way when I go to the gynecologist. I'm like trying to look all natural, and I did make the trip to the bathroom, and I still need to pee and have gas, but I'm the kind of girl who would like fake my own death if either one of those things happened, and my pacemaker goes off, and anyway, it's not a pleasant experience for me to be up here, but I had the kind of sponsor who told me that she always, you know, and I'm glad this is a topic, because she never just said, because I said so. She would always give me a reason. And I remember I had been asked to tell my story. I had probably about a year, and I was one of those people who got here. And I thought that I had escaped all my problems. I thought, whew, I got here just in the nick of time. And then all my stuff came flying in the front seat. All my pigeons came home to roost. And so I wasn't in a really good place when I got asked to speak. And I went to her and I said, I don't have anything to tell these people. I mean, what do you want me to say? Stay sober and your life can suck too? And and she said, if you can find it in the big book where it says you can say no, then you don't have to tell your story. And like a sucker, I went pouring through that book because I just knew there had to be a please don't, you know, spread the disease clause in there somewhere. And what I found came to be my favorite paragraph in the big book, and it's page 102. And it says, your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. Keep on the firing line of life with these motives, and God will keep you unharmed. And that's the only reason I ever accept an AA request, if there's any way I can do it, is because I am so incredibly selfish. I really love what I have today in my life. And I don't ever want to go back to the way I was living when I walked through these doors November the 14th of 1985. I did not get here because I had, you know, a broken nail and the tennis game was off. I got here because I was sucking on the end of a gun, wanting to pull the trigger, wishing I had the courage. And so for me, this is that life and death issue for me. I don't do things. I'm never one of those people who sat in the back of the room and said, I want to do that. I remember thinking, I don't have anything important enough to say that I want to go up there. But what I've learned in AA is to be a good worker bee. And what I've learned is whatever that service position is, I need to ask myself if I can help carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because general service is only one service. Page one of the service manual tells you that anything that helps carry the 12 steps, helps carry that 12-step message, that is service, not just general service. So that person who's always there when you walk through that door, that person who, the literature that mysteriously gets put out on the table, whatever it is important. But our topic today, our critics can be our benefactors. I thought I was given this topic specifically as a punishment. Because I had a lot of questions when I got here. My sponsor is here today. It's all her fault. And people, when I introduce her, they go, oh, I'm, God bless you. But I had the sponsorship that never told me because I said so, because it's always been that way. Someone sat down and helped me find the answers and helped me find out why we do what we do. But I'll tell you something. We do a lot of stuff that people say, I don't know why we do it. My favorite thing to do at the end of a meeting when we circle up, and I was with people who, I got shipped off to chemical camp. And so, you know, you get indoctrinated, get in the circle, do this, say that. But I think about that when you see that frightened look on a newcomer's eyes when we get up, no cue, get in a circle, and my favorite thing to do is to take their hand and say, we do the hokey pokey at the end of the meeting. Right foot first. because we do a whole lot of stuff today that has kind of worked its way in that really doesn't have jack to do with staying sober or carrying the 12-step message. But we do it, and it becomes that dogmatic. See, when we talk about people who think we might be a cult, we do some cult-like doo-doo here. Circling up, the chanting, the, you know. We forget when we come in here, and it becomes that natural, and it becomes the norm, that the outsider coming in. I remember my big brother came to a meeting one night. Showed up. He was out of town, and my mother told him where I was, and he walked into the end of the meeting. And he's a, like, very smart, overeducated fool. But anyway, at the end of the meeting, and when I got home, I said, well, what did you think? He said, I thought some of those people might need some medication. But I think it was we have this hidden language that we do sometimes. But there is that stuff. And I almost welcome the criticism we get from people from the outside. I was doing a prison meeting one time, and I remember the ladies telling me, it was a beginner's guidelines meeting, and they told me that the guard on their unit had told them, and they were very upset because they said, the guard told us just to go to AA for what they had to get done here and to go for a little bit of time after they got out until they got on their feet, but don't go forever. Those people are losers, and for God's sakes, don't hang out with them. And this Southeast Texas girl was like, point her out. I can take her. But my next thought was, I'm supposed to be an example, and I had that pause, and I said, well, gosh, why do you think maybe she thinks that? You know, we talk all the time about you may be the only example of the big book someone ever sees. What had to possibly be her horrible example of our program that she got to see that made her think that? That made her think that this is not a good place for those inmates to hang out and to try to get their lives back together. We are that walking, talking example. You know, when we're here this week, we are under a microscope this week. And every please and thank you, every tip you leave, everything we do speaks volumes about who we are this week. I have been in conventions and conferences and stuff when I've been like at a restaurant or a front desk, and I've watched one of my membership just be terrible to someone behind a desk or to a wait staff and wanted to crawl under a table. Because I thought, what do you think, and you know, all anonymous. What happens when the day comes when they might know somebody, whether it be them or a loved one, are they going to want to send them to us when they've seen us on our best behavior? You know, this is such an opportunity for us. I mean, you want to talk about a 12-step call. I'm here and I'm getting all this wonderful hoo-ha, but I'll tell you something. Our presence here, not just locally, but worldwide and how it gets reported out is huge. Huge. Our actions speak so much louder than anything we can ever put in print or anyone else can put in print. You know, when I think about that, I stood in line this morning, God bless them, whoever they were, but I stood in front of a couple of gentlemen who are making the most incredible racist remarks. And I just thought, you know, there's all kinds of other people not in our fellowship who are standing close by. And especially when we have these on, you know, it speaks volumes. So I really do. I've learned to appreciate when someone criticizes Alcoholics Anonymous because there's always a little bit of truth. One of my favorite lines is there's no waste in God's economy. You know, when I got here, I remember a woman telling me that my past was my most valued treasure. And I thought, oh, you have got to be crazy. I want to dig a big, deep hole and cover it up. My past is my most valued treasure because without it, I wouldn't be who I am today. And so every single criticism we get from within or without, I think we can look at and say, well, why might they think that? You know, that minority opinion that we value so highly here, gosh, anyone who's ever experienced that opportunity of thinking they knew exactly how they felt on something, and that one person shares and you go, phew, I want to change my vote. I laughed when Carolyn was reading about the demanding absolute answers to nitpicky questions. They were talking about the General Service Conference. Because if you haven't argued for an hour and a half over a comma in a period, you haven't lived yet. So, so I really do love this topic. Don't ever say, because I said so, or it's always been that way. Think about it. You know, think about the things we do. And not just does it make everybody, oh, the majority of the meeting's happy with it, if the majority's happy. You know what, I'll tell you what I think. I think if it keeps one person from walking in these rooms and feeling like they can come back, we shouldn't do it. I don't care if 9 out of the 10 or 1,000 out of the 1,200 or whatever it is, if it's a death sentence for one person, we shouldn't be doing it. And I just want to tell you, you've been watching us move down the food chain here. You got to have lovely Carolyn and her service work and Jimmy Jack. And trust me, I'm a rusted servant now. I'm waiting in God's waiting room. I just get to hang off the bottom end of the triangle now. But what a pleasure, you know. I have one of my sponsees here. I remember she came back to me one time at an area assembly as a past delegate. I was sitting back there, and she said, can I ask you a question because I'm confused? And I said, please, I love poisoning the minds of new GSRs. But what a privilege it is to pass on to others what's been passed on to me. I mean, that is absolutely nothing new under the sun. I get to pass on what was freely gifted to me in this program. And we all have an obligation in whatever, ever you do in service in Alcoholics Anonymous to pass that on. The key is to never believe your own press. And any of us in service know that it's very easy, and I always finish with my inappropriate story because it's me. But you know, it's not start thinking it's all about who we are. You know, and there's people, if you're sitting in the back room thinking, I want to do that, and you probably shouldn't do that, that it is about service to each other, freely given. And I can tell you that when I became a delegate in Idaho, they just showered me with so much love and affection. I thought they were going to play Hail to the Chief when I walked in the room sometimes, and it becomes a little overpowering, and especially for someone who's not real comfortable in front of people and crowds. But it's incredibly tempting to start thinking that you're really all that. And so my story has a biblical context, and it's just for backdrop, so you can hopefully think about this when you leave here. But I just want you to picture that it's Jesus is riding into Jerusalem on his donkey, and the streets are lined. I mean, it is packed, solid, and everyone is throwing flowers, and they're waving palms, and they're shouting, Hail to the Messiah, the Chosen One. Now, I want you to think for just one minute, what if the donkey thought all that was for him? Haven't I done that before? I'm seeing the same thing that he's seeing, and I'm thinking all the hoo-ha is all about me. I always need to remember I am just the jackass carrying the message. Thank you.
Wow, wow, wow. In the service manual, Bill writes, almost without exception, it can be confidently estimated that our best defense in these situations where we receive criticism is no defense whatsoever. When I assumed my first service position, my first service sponsor said to me, Buck, you need two ingredients. Service at a group level, service outside a group level, being a sponsor, being a friend, being an AA member. I asked him, what are those two ingredients? He said, broad shoulders and a strong back. Over the years, I have read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, our basic text, and I'm reminded of the beautiful passage that we find on page 118. If you both show a willingness to remedy your own defects, there will be little need to criticize each other. I am reminded that on page 125, the truest of the true, a man may criticize or laugh at himself, and it will affect others favorably. But criticism or ridicule coming from another person often produces a contrary effect. And last but not least were the four words that changed my life, and I try every day to say these words, and some days when I hear criticism either about me or something I love or someone I love, these words work great. And I'll leave you with this. Those four words are, bless them, change me. Bless them, change me. Please thank our panel once again. Later, I don't know if you want to do this or not, we have a few short minutes, for those who would want to make a few short comments. We do have that time. If not, we will close. Is there anyone here by show that wants to? We'll close with the Serenity Prayer. No, wait, someone, you have something to say? Please come to the microphone.
Hi, my name is Cheryl, and I'm from the Southwest Texas area.
Hi, Cheryl.
Welcome to San Antonio. I have a question, actually, and it's about the Lord's Prayer. Now, Madeline said if there's anything that keeps one alcoholic out of the rooms, it's wrong. So I'd like to know how you address somebody when they say, that's religion, and why should I come to AA?
Thank you for your question, Madeline.
Thank you for the question. I got sober here, several thousand meetings a week. I'll say the Lord's Prayer. I fell in lockstep. I was raised in a very religious home. I knew the prayer. I moved to eastern Idaho, where they do not say the Lord's Prayer. I moved to western Idaho, where they do. I had a young man who was Jewish who shared with me how alienated he felt coming to meetings with the Lord's Prayer. And what he said to me changed me forever. And I don't say the Lord's Prayer. I stand, and I'm quiet, and I say my own prayer. But my experience is when someone turns to me and says, would you like to take us out? I have to say no thank you, because I can't participate in a prayer of my choice. Thanks.
I'm Jesse Martin from Ukiah, California.
Hi, Jesse.
Hi. And I would like the name again of that general service. I've forgotten the position he held. Bob Pearson.
He was an advisor to the general service office.
Okay.
He was the general manager at one time.
Okay. And in what you read, I liked what he wrote. I have a question about one part of that, and that's outside literature. Did that mean that he was offering that we might use outside literature at meeting level?
Do you mind if I answer this? And please, thank you. That's a good question, and thank you for your question. If you have a book that we publish every year on advisory actions from the General Service Conference, please turn to the Literature Committee past considerations, and you'll find in 1972 that there was a consideration based on the fourth tradition as one of the principles, which was we don't, as AA, tell groups what they can or cannot sell, but here's what the conference asked. If you're going to sell material that's not from AA, please put it on another table. And that's all we say. Would anyone like to add to that? I think we have that. You had your hand up. Do you want to step to the mic?
Yeah, I'll be quick. Good afternoon. I'm Russell. I'm an alcoholic.
What accent is this?
What was that?
Where are you from?
I was up in a meeting in San Angelo the other day, and they asked me to read the chapter 5. And after, this is not what I was going to say, but anyway. After I'd finished reading it, and I said progress rather than progress, and this old Texan looked at me across the table, and he squinted a little bit, and he said, and what part of West Texas are you all from? But I was just going to talk about the Lord's Prayer, because I was quite shocked when we came to America and found people chanting the Lord's Prayer, because I've never heard it done at a meeting in Australia. But I'm not criticising you. I mean, that's the way it is. I mean, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. But I was glad to hear Madeline's slant on it, because I hadn't thought of that. You know, I've been saying it against my will, because I thought I might be ostracised if I didn't. But anyway, thanks for the meeting. It was great.
Thank you for being here. So you know, let's thank him. So you know, last night at the meeting, the meeting closed with the Lord's Prayer. Tonight the meeting will close with the Serenity Prayer. And tomorrow, the meeting will close with the responsibility pledge, so everyone gets a chance to criticize evenly as we go. And, sir.
Good day, everybody. My name's Alex. I'm an alcoholic.
I
started working for a brewery in Golden in 1978. We were allowed to imbibe throughout our workday, so I never had to suffer a hangover. But when I finally was throwing up blood, I'd finished off the third marriage, I was missing teeth, and driving a three-tone car, something came to me like a bolt that something had to change. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and surrendered. Now, I had a dilemma. I didn't know whether I could continue to develop silver bullets and shoot old werewolves, or what was I going to do? And I went to my sponsor, and he said, well, here's an idea. If you're willing to serve God faithfully while working there, you can continue. If you want to do it about you or just do it for the money, you need to get out of it. Mm-hmm. And that's what it came down to, and I ended up in emergency response. I became teachable. That was an interesting proposition for a redneck that went to Allen Military Academy in Bryan, Texas. Okay, I understand that one on the right there. I got a flat forehead from running into scrub oak, too.
I have no idea what you just said.
Well, ask the man to your left. We run into trees a lot. We're not real bright.
I see.
But I am teachable today, but it's by the grace, and it's also by the fact that I took on the heart of a servant. And when I work with my new guys, I do give them hell now and then, because I said, have you ever thought about this? And then I unload. But I do it gently. You know, I don't drop them out of a moving car. But, I talk about me, and if it reads their diary, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing, is I open my chest to them and show them a beating heart in front of them. It scares the hell out of them, but it gets it done. And me handing things to you and saying, this is subject to your approval, and you can drop it on the floor if you want to, and I'll pick it up and wipe it off and put it back in the sleeve. But servants win in everything. They're sending me back to school as a trauma medic, and I'm going to have to hang bags and needles over people, and I don't want to do it. But you know what? I'm going to go for it, because it's the only thing we got left. Thank you.
We have time for one more, and that person's at the microphone, and we'll finish with you.
Short and sweet. I'm Carol. I'm an alcoholic.
Hello,
I'm from
Carol.
Panel 48, Area 25, Kansas, Bible Belt, America. I sobered up in Kansas, and Kansas is Bible Belt America. And the majority of our meetings, we say the Lord's Prayer at the end of them. That didn't seem strange to me. We're a Christian-based community, and that's where most people from Kansas are. And I was totally unaware of the fact that anybody else would do a meeting any other way. But as I grew in Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out that when I went to New York to serve as a delegate, there are many people of many faiths there, and it offends them to be in a meeting and have to say the Lord's Prayer. I was unaware of that, and my home group was unaware of that. But, you know, as long as you're unaware, you don't change. And sometimes all we need to do is present that idea to my home group, which is, you know, autonomous. And I just said, you know, what if someone of Jewish faith or someone that is Buddhist comes in and doesn't want to say the Lord's Prayer? What do? We don't use the Lord's Prayer at our home group anymore. And, you know, it's a fully informed group conscience that we need, and we need that in the groups as well as at the district, the area, and GSO.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Excuse me, I know you just wanted one more. I have something real quick. My name is Arlen. I'm an alcoholic from Denver, Colorado. I also am Jewish, and I am not happy about the Lord's Prayer being used in meetings. But I want it, this may help someone. I have it on authority from a Hasidic rabbi the Hasidim are the Orthodox of the Orthodox. And this is a Hasidic rabbi who's in the program, as a matter of fact. And he advises that the Lord's Prayer is a translation of the Kaddish, which is an integral part of the Jewish service, of every Jewish service, and is a sort of a blessing of God, just a. But if you do have someone Jewish that is having a problem with the Lord's Prayer, that may be a good explanation for them. Thank you.
Thank you for your considerable remarks. We have a nice way of closing if you'd like to join us. We're going to close with the Serenity Prayer, and while you're standing up, we are really going to close with a Serenity Prayer. And while you're standing up, let's thank again Carolyn, Jimmy Jack, and Madeline. Ready? We're hooked up? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you all again.